Friday. It's the end of the week. It's Bob McCowan, John Shannon. And who would we rather talk to than our guest today to conclude the week? John Paul Morosi, our longtime buddy, pal, chum.
And, you know, he really wants to, he's a baseball guy, but he really wants to be a hockey guy. You know that, huh? Really wants to be a hockey guy.
Well, I don't think that's the case at all. He likes hockey, which is...
No, he loves hockey.
Which is okay. And I know you are a hockey guy. And of course, all hockey guys try and recruit other people.
I don't say a word to John about it. In fact, it might be the other way around.
You just sat here and said he wants to be a hockey guy. And
yeah, but I didn't recruit him.
That everybody should want to be a hockey guy.
Well,
exactly.
It's fun.
Hockey pucks are all the same. If you just stayed in your own territory, we'd leave you alone. But you try and suck everybody else into this territory simply to justify your own love of the game. We're happy you love the game. Just leave us alone.
Well, for 2 days, I will.
Yeah, it'll be Saturday and Sunday when we don't do a program. Paul Morosi, what are we going to talk about? Who the hell knows? There's no baseball. We'll see. Watch Shannon hijack the conversation.
Hockey.
We'll be back after these messages. Welcome back. I'm McCown, John Shannon with you. JP Morosi joins us from suburban.
I'm going to call him the hockey maven. He's a hockey maven. He's a hockey guy, you know.
First of all, that is the Hall of Famer Stan Fischler's title, so I cannot possibly infringe upon that. Legend, of course, in the U.S. and Canada is Mr. Fischler. But yeah, it's been great. We've had some good ice here the last few days. Been out there with my kids skating, so it's been a lot of fun.
You've posted it on Twitter that you're out there and doing the thing. We see you and we see the ice. We don't see you skating on the ice, John. We don't see any shots of you skating, but that's okay.
Okay. I can work on John. If you need to see proof of skating, I can do this at some point. I'm not sure if it's going to happen today, but I will do that and dedicate it to you. And as we were chatting a bit before the show began, I have one quick story to tell you along those lines about my quote unquote athletic ability. I put this in air quotes because as you both probably know, I was notably the quarterback of an 0-9 team in high school. 0-9. Mm-hmm. Over the summer we were interviewing the Hughes family at their home here in Michigan before the draft. Mm-hmm. And as I was leaving, I was leaving through the garage, and they have a beautiful little, it's like a stick handling game effectively where you're able to stick handle over this board and it gives you a rating on how well you did on it. And Luke says to me, "Hey, do you want to try it? Do you want to just see how you do?" I was like, "Sure, that'd be awesome." So I grab a left-handed stick, I'm left-handed, and I stick handle my way through this. And suffice it to say, I was not among the leaders of those who had played that game in that household. And Luke, I'll never forget this. Luke says to me, "John, you're kind of ruining your rep." And I thought to myself, Luke, you assume that I have a rep to ruin in this regard, that I'd be able to actually do this. So we were laughing about having a good laugh, but it was really, that's obviously an amazing household. What an incredible family they are. But just, I felt honored that he said, "Yeah, just, you know, grab one of the lefty sticks here and give it a shot." So it was a lot of fun.
Now, actually, if we're on the conversation of the Hughes boys, so there's Jack, there's Luke, there's Quinn. You get a sense how competitive they are with each other?
Very, very. And of course, we were hearing some fun stories about in 2020 when they were all home, obviously, when everybody's season was canceled. Think about the street hockey games, roller hockey games they were playing when they couldn't go anywhere. And they were just there with all that competitiveness. Very, very competitive, of course. But also the amount of love they have for each other is pretty extraordinary too. I thought it was important and really unique that Luke decided to wear number 43, which was the same number that Quinn had worn at Michigan. He's wearing it at Michigan now. So there's a real love. They support each other so much. I think the person who was happiest when Luke was drafted by the Devils was Jack. And you just saw Jack's reaction was just extraordinary. And to be in the house when that happened, as we were doing the the draft coverage was honestly one of my coolest moments in broadcasting, because that celebration under that roof, it shook the house. I mean, there was all the family and friends were all there, and that celebration to be able to play together was pretty cool. I mean, honestly, I've seen some incredible games, heard some great cheers in my life, but there have been very few things that were that pure as the joy under that roof when Luke was picked by Jack's team. So that was a pretty special moment.
Well, you were also scheduled to go to Edmonton for the World Junior, and I'm sure that was a disappointment when the plug was pulled on that.
It was. Yeah, Bob, thanks for asking. It was certainly something that I was looking forward to a lot. I was going to go up for the medal round, so I'd fly up there on New Year's Day and cover the quarterfinals on, and certainly tough. I mean, obviously it's disappointing for everybody, but especially the players. And I was just trading messages afterward with Nate Lehman, the U.S. head coach. And I think he put it best when he said originally he felt heartbroken for our players. And then the more he thought about it, he felt heartbroken for all players, because especially that 02 birth year, those kids, they lost their U18s because of the pandemic, and that whole tournament was canceled. And now it's their birth year that was playing this tournament, and they've lost it as well. So who knows if they can bring it back in the summertime, but it's, as you both know, it's such a special time of year. And the reason why, and it's been a lot of fun for me to cover this tournament, even just through the features and storytelling around it through the U.S. perspective, certainly, because it's fun for me as someone who loves hockey in the U.S. and certainly all around the world, but to hear the stories of families who have grown up with this tournament and have started to, in some small way, share the Canadian tradition around the event, where they're watching the games together on Boxing Day. They know what Boxing Day is. They know why Canada plays on Boxing Day. They have such respect for the way that Canada treats the tournament. And of course, the Hughes family, as we alluded to, they grew up for 10 years in Canada. They were playing in Mississauga. On the same, my favorite detail, on the same, both Jack Hughes and Luke Hughes played on the same lacrosse teams, club lacrosse, as Owen Power. How about that? And I once asked Owen about that. He said, yeah, I played attack because I wasn't very good on defense. I thought to myself, you probably were pretty good on defense too, Owen. I wouldn't sell yourself short. But it's really cool for me just to hear the tradition surrounding the event as it's grown here in the U.S., where this becomes it's a really, really special thing. It's an honor to tell the stories. And as I said, I just feel worse for the kids.
Hey, don't feel that sorry for those guys, because it looks like at least three members of the Michigan team, the Wolverines, are going to go to Beijing now because of what the NHL has done. So like Owen Power and I think Ken Johnson are both going to go and play for Canada. There's going to be a couple of the kids playing for the United States.
Right. It appears Matty Beniers and potentially Thomas Bortolo, who was going to be able to go to the tournament this year, but for the second straight year had a COVID-related reason that prevented him from going. So it would be an extraordinary part of the story for Thomas to be able to go. Of course, he grew up, as you both know, in the Montreal area. And I think at one point in time had four different countries for whom he could have played, because his dad had played for France and he had a Swiss hockey license, and he's a Canadian citizen as well in U.S. So and he's had a phenomenal season. I think the U.S., you could tell the way they're building this team, John and Bob, that they're doing a lot of college players and a lot of young centers. Beniers, a very young center, obviously, a World Junior eligible center. Bortolo, we've heard about Ben Myers, possibly from University of Minnesota. Matthew Nyes, who was on the World Junior team, he plays at Minnesota as well. So a lot of really cool storylines, a lot of younger players, which I think is good for the tournament. They saw it last time around. Two of their better players were college players in Donato and Greenway. So they saw a lot of youth really helping them out in Pyeongchang. And now it's time for a new chapter to get ready very quickly. I think, John and Bob, the question I have is going to be traveling in and out and how many games they'll miss. And at what point in time do they have to travel over? So when is their last weekend series with Michigan before departing? I certainly think for U of M, clearly they're still in a great place to make the tournament, but they're now going to be missing key players for the second stretch of time this season, which is obviously not exactly how they drew it up in the fall.
Well, I don't think Mel's too worried about making the postseason. I don't think
he should be fine. I will point this out, John. The Michigan's last Big Ten series before the holiday break, they split with mighty Ohio State. And as Bob knows, Ohio State's program's getting better and better. Mason Lowry, very good defenseman. Bob, the Buckeyes are good on the ice right now, my friend.
Well, they weren't good enough on the football field this year because they lost to you-know-who.
I wasn't going to bring it up. This was, Bob, this is a hockey conversation, my friend.
Well, no, hey, but listen, let's face it, though. The most exciting college football of the season, their last games, you're only as good as your last game. And the Wolverines weren't very good in their last game. And the Buckeyes played the most entertaining football game of the year at the Rose Bowl.
There you go. I'll be curious to see what the final rankings look like. They'll probably still have Michigan ahead of Ohio State. Same number of losses, right? And we'll see. And we'll see next year, Bob. It's back in Columbus, my friend. So we'll see how Michigan handles things in 2022.
Well, for the past decade, that hasn't mattered really where they played the game. They could have played it in a parking lot, and Ohio State would have beat those Michiganders. But I'm happy for you because the losing streak was starting to become a little embarrassing for me. And I like it better when I can chastise you occasionally. It just felt like I was piling on the last few years. So,
well, you're a great friend, Bob, and I appreciate that. Well, that's what makes a rivalry. At some point in time, the Red Sox had to win. They had to beat the Yankees. It took them 86 years to do it, but they finally did it. And then, of course, it changed the rivalry a little bit. But to have a rivalry, you have to have balance. Again, we talked about the U.S. and Canada at the World Juniors. There's balance. They've taken turns winning tournaments the last 10 years or so, and it's all about the balance and the rivalry.
Well, you probably wouldn't know this, but I mean, I used to have an Ohio State logo on the wall over there.
And, right.
I've taken it down. Commemorative of the loss to Michigan, and it shan't go back up until Michigan is defeated once again by the Buckeyes. Although I was going to bring it over here and show it to you. I can't find it. I don't know where the hell it went. And I didn't want to, we morphed into football here, and I was going to get to football, but on another topic, we'll go back to it later. But we're talking about, you know, a bunch of non-NHL players going to the Olympic Games. The stature of the Olympic Games is such that it is presumed that you get the best athletes in the world in virtually every sport. And now really it is every sport. I can't think of, is there a sport out there that where the professionals don't play? Well, the only one would be the best in the world. The only one would be soccer, really.
Baseball. Well, baseball.
Well, you have some of them.
You have some. You have some. Soccer. Soccer.
Soccer is an age restriction, right?
Right, exactly. There's an age restriction in soccer. In baseball, you have the best players from Japan, Korea, many of the countries. They'll stop their season, which of course was the case in Tokyo. So the best Japanese players were there. The U.S. still made it, obviously, and won silver at the end to Japan. Japan, of course, won gold. So you do see some of the best, but not all of the best uniformly. And so I think that in some ways, the baseball tournament in many years will sort of approximate what the hockey tournament will be this time, because you'll have great players from the KHL, similar to what you would see from other top pro leagues around the world in baseball. So you'll have some of the best KHL players. And then again, on the US and Canada front, you'll have players on those teams that are NHL caliber now. Owen Power could play in the NHL now. Jake Sanderson could play in the NHL now. Manny Bedeers from the U.S., Kent Johnson from Canada, they could all play in the NHL today and succeed. And so I think what you'll see is probably a level of play somewhere between the World Juniors and a normal and probably like between the World Juniors and a really competitive NHL game. It's probably where
You've hit the nail on the head here. So soccer has under 22s. That's who plays in the Olympic Games.
Right.
We now have essentially, for the most part, junior age players going to the Olympic Games. Is there, and the National Hockey League has now publicly stated, well, we'd rather be in the Summer Olympics than in the Winter Olympics. Now, whether that's true or not, or whether that's posturing or negotiating or whatever it is.
Or pause.
But is there merit to the notion that every 4 years, the World Junior Championship should be the Olympic Championship? In other words, replace the World Junior with the Olympic Games and just forget about the NHL altogether.
It's a fair question. I like there being true best on best at obviously multiple age levels. I love the World Juniors every year. And then I am already looking forward to the next Olympic Games in 2026 when they're in Italy, and hopefully the world's in a little different place by then. I think we should all hope and expect that's going to be the case, and that we will see the best NHL players go to Italy. We saw that happen in 2006 in Torino, and obviously it's in the same region of Italy, or same general portion of the country. It's in the north again, in Milano and Cortina. I think for me, that would be a thing that I'm really looking forward to for the future. And I think it's going to be feasible. I think the league begrudgingly put this in the CBA, as you both know, the players. It's been now, think about it, since Sochi that we had a last Olympic tournament. And then since 2016 with the World Cup that we had a best on best at the senior level. So by the time the Olympics roll around in 2026, unless we have a World Cup between now and then, it's going to be 10 years since our last best on best tournament. And you're going to have a whole generation of players where Austin Matthews has never played for the U.S. at the senior level. Connor McDavid's never played for Canada at the senior level. So there's a lot of players who have never checked that box of wearing their country's crest in a tournament like that. I think we need it. And so I'd like to see both the World Cup at some point in the next couple of years, hopefully, and then send the very best to Milano in 2026.
That's all very well and good, but the best sport the most popular sport in the world, soccer, has their own event. It's called the World Cup. And they don't try and undermine it deliberately or otherwise by sending their best anywhere else, including the Olympic Games. So they come up with this notion of, okay, well, the Olympics will send the under 22s. And now you have, it's the World Cup. If you're in the World Cup of soccer, that's it. That is the biggest, that's probably the biggest, I think without question, sporting tournament in the world.
Mm. If it rivals the Olympics now, Bob.
Sorry?
It rivals the Olympics now, I think.
I think it's big. Well, for soccer, it is the Olympics.
Yeah.
And I think where the NHL has missed the boat is this notion that you should play in the Olympics. They suspend their season. The owners don't like it. It's economically challenging. Now you got COVID. That's another thing altogether. Why not? You know, but where they've missed the boat is they've dropped the puck, or dropped the ball, if you will, on a World Cup over and over and over again. They haven't been able to get that right over an extended period of time. There's a ton of excuses that I don't care about. But do what soccer's done. Build your World Cup. It's much better economically for the players and for the owners. It's easier to control. You don't have to worry about where it is. Do that, and then, I mean, come do something else with the Olympics. As I said, maybe follow soccer's path. Maybe it isn't under 20s. Maybe it's under 22s. Get to go to the Olympics. Thoughts on that?
Well, a couple of things. I'll make my thoughts on this one brief and send it to John as well. But I think in general that hockey's orientation around international sports is one of the things I love the most about it. I agree that we could see a setup similar, whether it's a Canada Cup, World Cup, in more of its recent iterations. And I believe we would have seen that, Bob and John, by now, had it not been for COVID. I think we probably would have seen a World Cup at some point in this general range of years, had COVID not happened and changed everything. But I do think that in general, there is a certain wisdom to controlling your own tournament and putting it on in conjunction with the Players Association, which is basically what baseball's done with the World Baseball Classic.
Same thing.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. Well,
and has the World Baseball Classic worked, John?
I believe it has. It has worked in different ways. Obviously, the U.S. won the most recent version in 2017. We hope that once baseball gets a new CBA, that the World Baseball Classic returns as well. It has done a couple things. I do think it has helped market the game around the world. It's helped grow the game in countries where the sport is just kind of starting to pop. Colombia is one of them, for example, where their talent level has really risen in recent years. And when you look at how much international baseball means and the national team and the prestige around it. When you think about the passion, how if you wanted to have an hour-long discussion any day of the year, any year, about who should be on Team Canada, you could do that. And they would be passionate. You'd have people calling in, weighing in with a lot of really good arguments. That conversation doesn't really happen all that often in the U.S. around baseball. But any other country, the Dominican Republic, Venezuela, Mexico, Japan, Korea, they would, if this show was happening in any of those countries and you wanted to say who should play for Samurai Japan, as the team is known in Japan, you would have extraordinary debate, passion all the time. And so I think take how Canada feels about the national hockey team and who's going to be on the national team. That is how all these other nations feel in the World Baseball Classic. And that's one of the main reasons why it's been such a success commercially, TV ratings, sponsorships all around the world.
See, I think sending the world junior players to the Olympics is a no-brainer. I think every 4 years, it just makes a ton of sense. However, what has happened is that in a non-pandemic time, the World Junior Hockey Championship is such a great revenue generator for those involved, in whether it's in Europe or whether particularly it's in Canada. The question becomes is, well, how do they get their money out of it? How do Hockey Canada, it makes really its money at two events a year, the World Hockey Championships with sponsorship and the World Juniors every 3 years when they're played in Canada. So if you're able to find a way to make sure that the governing bodies still get their money, then I think there'd be a lot greater appetite to send the World Junior players to the Olympics. And it would be a hell of a tournament. And it would create, because the competitive balance is there amongst the top five or six teams, there would be enough interest in hockey, the quality of hockey, the style of the game, that it would be almost, in my opinion, as impactful of having NHL players there.
I think, John, that you're right, that we're going to see a very high level of play at this tournament, the Olympic tournament. I think especially just because these, especially the young players, they just had the chance to represent their country at the World Juniors taken from them. The amount of passion that they're going to have to be able to have a second chance at this at an even higher stage, really, will be extraordinary. I think that the hockey is going to be great. And John, to your point, it's interesting. I'll borrow a quick story from the baseball world, that with baseball being an Olympic sport in Tokyo, and of course it's not going to be in Paris, but we do expect it will be in Los Angeles in 2028. But when baseball is in the Olympics and it's an Olympic sport, even if it's just for one cycle, what I've heard from a lot of different executives in sort of quote unquote smaller baseball countries or developing baseball countries is that their governments in many cases will fund their own grassroots baseball program based on, in many years, is this an Olympic sport or not? Does it have a chance to get us on the Olympic stage or not? And so from the standpoint of funding, to your point, John, that is a crucial question, whether the format ends up being a Hockey World Cup, Baseball World, Baseball Classic, whatever it might be, versus the Olympics. It's so crucial for those countries that are just now getting up there. You think about some of the countries in Europe where you've seen great growth for hockey in the last 10, 20 years. You still need to be able to have the money to build a rink, to have a national tournament, national infrastructure. And when it's an Olympic sport and you have your players in the Olympics, governments tend to want to spend more money.
We got to take a break. We got other things to talk about. Usually we discuss baseball with Morosi.
What?
And there is none. And it's not just because of the offseason, as everybody knows. But we'll get to that and some other things when we come back after these messages. McCown and Shannon back with you. JP Morosi with us from Michigan. Let's double back a little bit. We sort of were talking college football a bit. And I have a question for you that occurred to me. In the midst of Ohio State losing to Michigan, Michigan getting waxed in the national championship playdown, and Ohio State almost pulling off a miracle at the Rose Bowl, one of the things that may have been lost in this was the presence of how to describe them. A team that would be, at the beginning of any season, considered one of the others. And that's the University of Cincinnati, who are not on anybody's A-list of places you want to be recruited if you're a high school football player. They're not at the top of the list. They're not in the top 10. They're probably not in the top 30, Morosi, in terms of recruiting power. But this is a team that rattled off an unbeaten season and then gave Alabama a little scare. They were not horrible. They didn't get blown out, if you will. And I started thinking about, well, we know what the presence on national television on a regular basis, a competitiveness for a national championship, what that means to recruiting for a school. In other words, I think Michigan will have a good recruiting offseason because they played better and they beat Ohio State. What does it do for a Cincinnati? Cincinnati presumably next year will have no games on national television. May not have more than a handful of games on regional television. I don't know what kind of a TV deal they've got, but not many people are going to see the players at Cincinnati. There's a nucleus of good talent there. But what does this past season do for them, in your opinion?
You know, Bob, it's an interesting question. Obviously, they're very well coached. And when you take a step back to your point, if you had told someone 5 years ago from Ohio that there will be a, you know, a 4-team playoff in the 2021-2022 season, and that Cincinnati would be in it, and Ohio State wouldn't. Right? That's just that is mind-blowing. And I think a couple things. We still see with Cincinnati, they are in geographically a very unique place because they're in a state that we know objectively produces extraordinary amounts of high school football talent in Ohio. And they're also right across the river from Kentucky, and therefore the South is right there. And so you're in a really unique recruiting spot where you're close to almost everybody. Like if you took the old compass and drew a circle around Cincinnati, a 4 or 5 hour drive, there's a lot of talent in that radius. And I think that helps them out in a huge way. I also think, Bob, one thing that you referenced is interesting in that if I'm a 17, 18 year old recruit, and I'm looking at where I'm going to go and can my parents watch us play? Often the question is, yes, they can drive there because Cincinnati is so centrally located in our country, number one. And number two, when it comes to the distinction between what is on broadcast television, regional TV, it's all on here. It's all on the phone anyway.
Oh, so
from that standpoint, I think those distinctions where it used to be a huge deal that we knew that Michigan would play a noon game on ABC and Keith Jackson's upstairs calling it, it's such a different time now that I think those distinctions are lost to a great many recruits.
Well, but you would understand, and I mean, I'm not trying to be critical here, but this thing, you know, maybe 20,000, 30,000 people will watch a Cincinnati game on this thing. Meanwhile, at the same time, 20 million are watching Ohio State on Fox or ESPN or wherever they happen to be playing. And virtually every single Ohio State game is on national television. Virtually every single game. You can't recruit against that. And yet, you know, here's a good program. I mean, I would say to you, if I was the dean at the University of Cincinnati, what I'd be doing is lobbying to get into the Big Ten, because that's about the only way you can get that, you know, that kind of recognition. Thoughts?
Well, I would say, Bob, clearly they are able to still, just based on the amount of talent that's in Ohio and identifying the right players who have a chance to flourish in their player development model. When you look at it, how often? It might happen a couple times, maybe for a Cincinnati kid who wants to stay really close to home. But as you know, Columbus is just up the road.
Yeah.
It's going to be very hard for Cincinnati to take a 5-star recruit and take him away from Ohio State. That it might happen, but it's going to be rare. What you have to do is identify the right 2 or 3-star recruit who you can really develop and fits your culture well. and bring them in, because they're not going to have a chance to be the starting quarterback at Ohio State. So you take him and really, really coach. And I think that's where the value of coaching is so crucial. And really, Cincinnati, as you know, Bob, has been good before. Brian Kelly was
Cincinnati. Sure.
Yeah, before he went to Notre Dame. So there, it's not totally unexpected, I would say. And we have seen teams, whether it's Boise State, whether it was Central Florida at different times, when you're in a spot that's unique and you're well coached and you understand what kind of players you're bringing in to fit your system, you can get pretty good pretty quickly.
Well, and you bring up, I think, a really good point, John, is that in the end, it's not the recruitment of players. It's creating the star coach, and the star coach can get players. And the problem is that these mid-majors, they can't keep their coaches because they can't pay them. They can't pay them the same as, you know, anybody in the Big Five, in the Big Five conferences. I mean that to me is the, I mean, let's face it. Nick Saban's the star of the University of Alabama. He's the star, you know, end of the game. First interview, Nick Saban, not the players, Nick Saban. So he becomes the greatest recruiting tool that any university has. And Brian Kelly's the best example. You know, Brian Kelly did a great job for the Bearcats, but in the end, they couldn't compete with Notre Dame dollars in order to keep them.
And never will be able to.
That becomes the issue. And they never will be able to.
And if you're a recruit, we all know this, the danger of, you know, first of all, it takes a few years at least for a Brian Kelly to establish that level of competence and trust that this is a good coach. And now you go, okay, well, I want to play for this guy. But then you say, well, what are the chances this guy is here 4 years from now when I'm getting ready to graduate, when I'm going to be a senior? What are the chances that since University of Cincinnati is going to be able to keep him? And the answer to that question is not very big. Hmm. There's a greater chance that this coach, if he's as good as he appears to be, is going to wind up going to a 1A major power, and I'll be sitting here at the University of Cincinnati with somebody else.
But remember, the one thing that's
they allowed to transfer now.
Exactly, as John said.
Well, I get it.
The transfer rules have changed everything. And and you see now players moving around from team to team in the transfer portal. It's changed college football. It's changed college hockey, for that matter.
Right.
Where a lot of players are moving around. And I really think, Bob, that players, they want to know, do I have a chance to win? Can my family watch me play? Can this coach get me to the NFL if I'm good enough? And Cincinnati's got a chance to win. They'll have, you know, your family can watch you play. And clearly they've got a pedigree and a track record of getting guys to the NFL. So if you check those boxes, those distinctions of what used to be the Big Ten is above everybody else, or the SEC even, it's changed a little bit. I really think the transfer portal mitigates a lot of that concern about my coach leaving, because if I want to, I can leave too.
I just love the idea of, and I have no affiliation with Cincinnati. I mean, I'm from Ohio, but I'm from Columbus, so I'm a Buckeye. I have, you know, I don't care about the University of Cincinnati, but I just love the story of the quote unquote smaller school who rises and challenges the behemoths, even if they don't win. We were talking yesterday, basketball. We were talking about Fred VanVleet when he was at Wichita State, and how they went to a Final Four. You know, a small, relatively small school who doesn't have any recruiting power, every once in a while jumps up and at least bites at the heels of the big guy. Mm-hmm. Well, those are great stories, aren't they? That's why we watch sports. That's
exactly right.
And it's the same. And in the end, particularly basketball and football, it's the same schools basically that win the championships every year. It's a handful. You can put them in a bag and pull them out and say, oh, they're not a surprise. Whether it's an SEC team in football or, a Big Ten team in basketball. I mean, it's always going to be the same group of top tier universities that win the championships for the most part.
Well, it raises a question for me, and I didn't intend to get into this conversation, but when you have the kind of dominance that Alabama has had in football. And I mean, I know we can go back, well, sort of, to the UCLA basketball days with John Wooden, where they won a million championships.
Man, you're old. Holy smokes.
Well, at least I've read about it. And that's not good for the game, really. Like, dynasties are fantastic. I love dynasties. But like 10, 11-year dynasties is a bit much. You know, like the Boston Celtics in the NBA at one point. There comes a point where everybody gets bored with it. I'm getting bored with Alabama.
Yep.
And it raises the question, is there something in the recruiting process? I mean, I know this is supposed to be amateur sport. We all know it isn't, but we know there's huge amounts of money involved in this. But should there be some sort of limitation on a school having the power to go out and recruit the best athletes year after year after year, knowing that they're going to get the vast majority of them? Not a draft per se, but the essence of a draft is intended to mitigate the possibility of a team remaining strong over a period of time. Give the other guys a chance. You win a Stanley Cup, you draft last in the first round. You win a World Series, you draft last in the first round. NFL, same thing. College sport, you get to perpetuate over and over again. Should we be doing
you get to perpetuate over and over again, because particularly in the football world, because I mean, I'm sorry, that's my theme today. Follow the money. The revenue generated in a good football program makes the university a better place to be. How much revenue?
That's theoretical.
Remember the years that Joe Paterno was the most powerful guy on campus at Penn State, because he would actually, he played such a role. He was deciding where the money from the football program went, that he would fight with the president and fight with the deans about where the money would go. That happens all the time. I mean, so you can't say we're going to limit Alabama to, you know, you're only allowed five star recruits because we have to spread it out. Alabama's going to say, hold on now. We want to fill our stadium every game. We want our revenues high so that we can reinvest in our campus. That's the reality of what football's become. It's become a business, a moneymaker for these universities to improve the campuses.
But Morosi, is it healthy for the long term for the game overall to have the same school at the top of the food chain year after year after year?
Well, it's a fair question, Bob. I would be curious to see how, for example, and we don't know this yet, but how the ratings will look for an Alabama-Georgia championship game versus if the championship game was in a year where it was Alabama against Oregon, Alabama mm-hmm. against Ohio State, Alabama against Notre Dame, where you have a team from two different regions. This obviously will be one of the most closely watched television programs in the Southeast of the U.S. all year long. It's going to be a must-see cultural event, but how will they feel about it in St. Louis or Milwaukee or Boston? Will they be as invested in it? So I do think the Alabama Crimson Tide have become like the Patriots in a certain way, where they're there every year for a long period of time. I don't think, to your earlier question, Bob, I don't think we'll ever see any sort of a draft or talent allocation entering college sports in this country. It's so counter to the foundation of the culture of American college athletics.
Okay, but what about limiting scholarships? I mean, one of the only things you can do is, you know, if you're in Alabama, you lop off one scholarship a year.
I don't think that really is terribly.
It probably won't make a bunch of a difference,
right?
But at least perceptually, it'll say, you know, we are trying to bring everybody together.
Right. Well, one thing that does happen, and that is really not one of the sunnier parts of the college recruiting process is that you hear about the practice of over recruiting, whereby a team will recruit more players and promise scholarships to more players than they have
scholarships
spots for, assuming that some will either be ineligible or not eventually not choose the school, and all of a sudden they get to signing day and wait a minute,
we got too many.
Yeah, exactly. And then that creates a real issue. And there are some kids that really have some adverse effects as a result of this. The other point I'll make quickly, that's unique. And while I say this from the American perspective, that we'll never see a draft entering college athletics, as you both know, we have that in the CHL. So in the hockey world, doesn't matter if you grew up in Mississauga, if you're drafted to play in Sudbury, you're going to Sudbury or you're going to Guelph, unless you can find a way to have your rights traded by your parents, yeah, or your advisor getting involved in it. So I think it's so interesting that if you were to tell an American parent, hey, guess what? If you live in Winnipeg, but you're drafted by Brandon or wherever it might be, you're going and you're going to live with a billet, and that's how you do it when you're 16, 17 years old. A lot of American families would say, wow, that's totally unexpected and something.
No, but
totally
I'm not going down that road. That's ridiculous because it's never going to happen. I'm trying to come up with some, just a conversation about the potential of equalizing the talent base or limiting the powerful schools from continuing to be powerful.
And I just don't think it's ever going to happen. Yeah. And part of it too, Bob, that's unique, is it's all about where your recruiting base is. And when you consider, take a school like Pitt, which at times, you know, you think about Tony Dorsett in that era, but as the population and you think about the smaller mining communities in Western PA, as mm-hmm. some of those jobs have gone away, it changes your recruiting base a little bit, and you're not as much of a powerhouse team. So I do think that in college football in particular, in the U.S., you really do see some fluctuations based on population. You would consider states that are having large influxes of people moving there and that have strong football cultures will find more and more players and will be able to keep them closer to home and really sustain those programs into the future. It's really an interesting demographic study as much as anything else.
And that said, there are a ton of players from Texas and Florida all over the country.
Yes.
Yeah. It also speaks to, and I'm going to take the conversation and steer it hard right. It also speaks that we've gone 43 minutes when you're a baseball guy, and we have not touched on what's not happening in baseball.
And that's why we haven't touched on it, because there's not much happening. Yeah. Morosi, you tell us. What do you hear?
There's not much new at the moment, my friends. I do think that we will see some conversations pick up hopefully next week. But as we speak today on a Friday, there has not been, to my knowledge, any new proposal, any new negotiation between the sides on core issues in a month. And I would say that when we left Dallas, when the lockout began, I would have expected that to basically be the case, that we have not seen much new and much substantive until we get closer to the start of spring training. And I suppose on some level, when you take a step back, we know what the key issues are, and the principals that are at the bargaining table know it as well. If they really, really wanted to make a deal, they know, the parties on each side know what the key aspects of this are, and they could hammer out the key issues if they really wanted to in 10 minutes. They know, the union knows what MLB wants and vice versa. They just are not ready to make that compromise yet. And I suspect we will see both sides take some very hard postures between now and the start of spring training, which is really the next hard deadline about a month from now.
So is this playing right into Rob Manfred's playbook?
I think that a couple things, that both sides realize that there probably has to be urgency to get a deal done on mm-hmm. either side.
That happens in every negotiation.
Correct. Yes.
Everywhere in the world.
I don't know that this sports
anywhere.
Yes. So to John's question, I don't know that this right now favors either side in terms of waiting. I certainly do think the players on their level, they will feel that urge to obviously not miss a paycheck and want to get back into camp. And on the same token, the owners, They don't want to miss the revenues that come with spring training games and regular season games. So there's a lot of revenue to be had there. Plus, with baseball right now, you've got a lot of new sponsorships in the sports gambling space. You've got a new TV deals coming up to begin this year. So there's a lot of incentive from the MLB side to get the game back on the field as well.
The only reason I really ask it is that this group of players really has never gone through a labor dispute.
Right.
So other generations would have said, oh, yeah, well, this happens all the time. But usually in ownership and management, there's a, well, we've done this before. Let's be right. Patient. So the new kids on the block are the players that have never lived it. And
right.
So do they get angst before anybody else?
They may. And obviously one thing that's unique, John, is that we have seen substantial contracts handed out to the high-end players, but it's still that middle tier of free agents, that the middle class, if you will, that the union is most concerned about and that really wants to get handled and sort of improve their situation in this next round of negotiations. It's also interesting that you've got Max Scherzer is one of the more influential people in the union. And he, of course, just signed a massive contract with the Mets. And he probably doesn't want to miss any of those paychecks coming up, because there's some pretty significant paychecks coming up for him in the future and a lot of the other leaders in the union. So it's a really unique set of circumstances here. I do think that we will find a way to not miss games. But it's for now, it's been very quiet. And I keep trying to remind everybody, including myself, that while we have seen, to Bob's point, other leagues have labor stoppages in recent years, they've all eventually found their way back up and running. You know, the NHL in 04, 05, and then the lockout in 12, 13, those were some dark days. But you know what? They've been back and they've had labor peace and they're flourishing right now. So it's
but they haven't had a World Cup. Ahead. They haven't had a World Cup, though.
No.
That's the problem.
Well, got to get that back, John. We got to get that back.
Invariably is the case. The key to any kind of labor dispute is the calendar and then the clock.
Yeah. Hey, before we let John go, quick question. Buck Showalter, were you shocked that Showalter got a job with the Mets?
I wasn't, because I really think that he checked a lot of the boxes that the Mets were looking for. He does have a lot of credibility in the game. He has coexisted brilliantly with star players in the past, Adam Jones, Manny Machado in Baltimore, and gotten the best out of them. Incredibly organized, detail-oriented. The Mets are an organization that, as we all know, they've been looking for a little bit of stability, integrity, consistency for a long time for a variety of reasons. They need someone with his presence, and I think he's already building a very impressive staff. He is someone that will be able to, we used the word earlier, recruit effectively just based on his persona and his willingness to put in the hard work to win. So I think Buck is a really good choice by the Mets. And of course, he was a colleague of ours at MLB Network for a number of years. So he knows New York. He managed the Yankees. So there's not a whole lot that Buck is ever going to be surprised by. I think he's the right guy for the job there with the Mets.
Morosi, stay well, stay healthy, and we thank you as always, and we look forward to having an opportunity to talk to you soon, more about baseball, we hope.
Yes, Happy New Year to you both and all of our great listeners, and yes, any conversation that we have, hockey, college football, baseball, we touch them all, my friends. I'll always love catching up. Thank you so much.
See you, pal. John, Paul, Morosi, we'll come back and wrap it after these messages. Our thanks to John Paul Morosi for joining us. McCown and Shannon back with you. And
there was enough. A little baseball talk. There was a little baseball talk.
There's a lot of hockey talk in there, though.
I think you brought a lot of it up, though.
Well, I'd rather swim downstream than into the current.
No,
you know what I mean.
Oh, pardon me.
I don't have the energy anymore to fight you at every turn. If I'd have started with baseball or football or something else, you'd have turned the conversation right away. Turned it right away, and that would have been the end of it. And then I wouldn't have anything to go back to.
But you do
on a regular basis, by the way, on this program. Hijack the conversation into a topic that you either A, want to talk about, or B, think you know something about. And then I'm
more
stuck.
More the former than the latter.
Well, either way. on that note, I assume you want to mention this Winnipeg Jets story.
Well, which
I
think
is absurd. And just demonstrative of the greed, lust, and pestilence of professional sport, and specifically the National Hockey League.
Well, no, you can't be paying your players and not putting people in your arena. So if there's an arena that's a relatively short distance away that will allow you to put 15,000 people in it, I think you have to do that investigation. That's what's happened.
It's unbelievable how you are able to twist this away from money and greed. Because you have a fan base in Winnipeg with a sport that abandoned that city once. Mm-hmm. And they've had to build back up that trust. These are passionate fans in Winnipeg. It is not their fault. It's not their fault they can't go there and to the arena. And now you're saying, oh, well, there's an arena like a few hundred miles down the road in Saskatchewan where we could play and we can make money off it. So screw the people in Winnipeg.
Well, no,
we're not the Winnipeg Jets anymore. We're going to be the Saskatchewan Jets.
But this is what's happening, Bob, is that this stuff is leaking out. This news is leaking out because the teams are trying to put pressure on the provincial authorities to open up the protocols. That's exactly what's happening.
Well, I don't.
They don't want to go to Saskatoon.
This is just this imaging is really bad, in my opinion.
I think if I'm
a Winnipeg Jets hockey fan living in Winnipeg, who went through all those years where my team was taken away from me, we struggled to get it back. We've got.
Did you feel the same way about the Raptors last year?
Meaning what?
Well, the Raptors didn't play in Toronto.
Couldn't, John. There's two different things. They played in the U.S. because they had to play in the U.S. because players couldn't come across the border. They were going to play in front of no fans, no matter where they played.
Well, in the end, if you can put 15,000 people in to watch your games, you still put them on television, still deliver them to your fans back at Winnipeg in the short term, it's not a bad idea.
BS. It's a terrible idea. It's the worst idea ever. And Cheveldayoff and the rest of the people.
Well, it's not his idea. It's above him.
Should stand up and say, look, we're not going to abandon our city just for a few bucks. We got to go. Have a nice weekend. Try and come to your senses. And we'll talk to you again on Monday. Goodbye, everybody.